Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Having a party? Whatever you're celebrating, Whole Foods Market has everything you need for a spectacular event. Premium meats, prepared foods, desserts, and more. Start every celebration at Whole Foods Market.
The new show Dead Boy Detectives is a spin-off of Neil Gaiman's beloved series The Sandman, both the comic and the Netflix series. It's about a pair of ghosts who refuse to move on to the afterlife. Aided by a young psychic, they stick around and solve mysteries that will resolve the unfinished business of other ghosts. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we're talking about the Netflix series Dead Boy Detectives on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the official Hacks podcast from Max. Join the creators and showrunners of Hacks as they discuss each episode and speak with the cast and crew about the making of the series. Listen to the official Hacks podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Third Love. Third Love makes solutions for every bra problem. Give yourself more lift, smoothing, and get straps that stay put. Every style's wear-tested on real women, made from premium materials, with a virtual fitting room to help you find your perfect fit. Comfort and support are guaranteed. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with code PODCAST15. This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Joining me today is Nikki Birch. She's a video producer for NPR's Jazz Night in America and also a co-host of the podcast A Thousand Eyes and One. Welcome back, Nikki.
Hey, hey. Nice to be back.
Great to have you. Also with us is filmmaker, pop culture critic, and iHeartRadio producer Joelle Monique. Hey, Joelle.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. Let's get to it. The Netflix series Dead Boy Detectives is based on characters created by Neil Gaiman, like the Netflix series The Sandman was. In Dead Boy Detectives, we meet Edwin and Charles. They're played by George Rextrew and Jaden Reverie. They are best mates, and they've got a lot in common. They're both ghosts of teenage boys who were brutally murdered at the same British boarding school. They've gone into business helping other ghosts who need mysteries solved so death can take them and they can move on to their afterlives. But Edwin and Charles have no interest in moving on themselves because it would mean they'd have to part ways. So they are on the run from death.
You ever think, what if death did catch us? She forced us to go to the afterlife and split up.
I will make sure that never happens.
As the series opens, they help a teenage psychic named Crystal Palace escape the clutches of a demon who's possessing her. She's played by Cassius Nelson.
Oh, but great job. Case closed, right?
Cross my name off your board so the demon must be gone, right?
Together, they leave London for Port Townsend, Washington, where they become trapped once a powerful supernatural feline entity, played by Lucas Gage, gets the hots for Edwin. They soon settle in and start solving supernatural crimes, all the while defending themselves from the local witch. She's played with fierce fabulosity by Jen Lyon. Dead Boy Detectives is streaming now on Netflix. Joelle Monique, start us off. What'd you think?
Glenn, it's so gay. It's so gay in the best way.
We will talk.
Fabulously queer. And I was so glad you have lesbians and gay couples and queer cat lords. And
yeah.
I loved watching the series. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought it was super fun to watch. I love Neil Gaiman and just kind of everything that he does. We've covered a couple of his books on our podcast. And It's always like a little bit horror, like kind of magical and whimsical. And this has got all of those things, you know, it's like, oh, this is real life. Ah, there's a ghost. And yeah, they just keep it going. Yeah, I was super excited to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's all about how you pitch it to people, right? Because If you lead with the premise, if the first thing you hear about this show is ghosts solve a different mystery every week.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of giving the CW, right? It's giving, you know,
exactly.
Tuesdays at 9, only on CBS. You know what I mean?
I mean, it is Greg Berlanti. Yeah. There are very heavy Riverdale vibes throughout.
Right. And that's not to denigrate. I'm just trying to classify here.
I hear you.
This is high concept procedural. And look, I've loved a lot of high concept procedurals in my time. Your Buffy's the Vampire Slayer, your X's File, but
yeah.
I mean, real talk, if I did not know this took place in the Sandman universe, based on the premise, I'd probably skip it because, you know, procedurals, this is a personal taste thing. Procedural's not my thing. Mystery of the week, monster of the week. But this is very squarely part of the Sandman universe. We meet a major player in that universe in the seventh episode, which I think is the best. But there is definitely a tonal tweak here, right? For all of its darkness of subject, which gets pretty dark, its approach is lighter. It's more overtly comic.
Yeah.
But that's a question I had for you both. Given that what the show is about, which, I mean, if you could look at it week to week, this show is kind of about abuse in various forms, much of which gets depicted on screen. Does that mix of light and dark work for you, Nikki?
It works for me for sure. Because if it was too bubbly, like Scooby-Dooby, I think they would have lost me. They are introducing you to all these conflicts. Like, these guys are running from death, and this woman, you know, she's fighting a demon that lives inside of her head, and you're getting terror in the form of abuse, and they're forced to deal with it throughout the season. And I like that. Nobody's running away from it. They're just, they have to confront it.
This is the thing I really love about Gaiman. I come across Neil Gaiman like later in life. I think I was 22 when I discovered the Sandman comics. They legitimately saved my life and inspired my move to LA. And it was like a huge life-changing revelation reading these comics. And so then I get into his childhood books. I was familiar with Coraline from the movie and then went back to my book. And I think what makes Neil Gaiman so great is his ability to talk to children about deeply disturbing things in ways that are neither pandering nor over their heads, which I think is such a difficult line to walk. And I really valued it as a kid who was, you know, reading way above my age range as a kid and who was having really dark thoughts very early in life. I think having a place like the Gaiman's universe where people can experience true horrors and there's still like love and light and hope at the end of everybody's journey, but not in a way that diminishes the tragedies they have to go through.
Yeah, I mean, gosh,
a really difficult line to walk, and for the show to be able to imbue that in its own imagery, especially and also feel like a solid companion piece to the Sandman series, which is so much darker. I mean, I think they did a lot of really great balancing work in here.
You know, what you're saying reminds me, like, I've been watching Neil Gaiman's Masterclass, and one of the things he talks about is truth and fiction, you know, skating that line between, I'm telling you stuff that happens in life, but let me make it, like, remove you a little bit from it so it's something that you can identify with, but from a distance.
Yeah. And one of the things that's a kind of hallmark of the Gaiman universe is, like, it's not just the mixture of light and dark. It's the mixture of the prosaic and the fantastic.
Yes.
So when you have, like, mundane, everyday British things like tea trays and towels and trolleys and
stiff upper lip.
The stiff upper lip and the British ability to kind of ignore anything that's untoward or outside their experience and focus on the prosaic while all these crazy things are happening. That's part of it. But Joelle, I wanted to bring up your point about the queerness of it. I was liking the show, right? I was vibing with it. Couldn't put my finger on why. I was only a few minutes into the first episode, and then my dog needed to be walked because dog splatters wait for no one. On the walk, I listened to the podcast Homophilia, where the guest happened to be Steve Yockey, who is a playwright, a TV writer. He developed this series for TV. He's one of its showrunners, and he was talking about how growing up, how much he obsessed over the character of Sue Ellen Ewing on Dallas, how it was his first exposure to the quote-unquote broken woman stereotype. And that's probably why he tends to write women, he says, who are complicated without worrying about things like likability, and how there are shades of Sue Ellen Ewing in everything he writes, as in the character of Esther the Witch on this show. And I stopped walking because I was like, oh, okay, I get it. That's what I was vibing with. It's queer. And sure enough, as the series goes on, as you mentioned, there's queer subtext, like those two dandelion sprites played by Max Jenkins and Caitlin Riley, who are maybe my favorite thing about the show.
The best.
Who are every toxic Los Angeles gay I have ever met. But then there's queer text, right? There's the Lucas Gage character. And, you know, your mileage may vary. You might read him as hot and flirty. You might read him as kind of a sex pest. You know, it's up to you.
Yeah, totally.
He's a little bit of both. We can't identify that he is both sex pest. Leave that boy alone. He's not ready for you. And also that, you know, he's a dude who's trying to figure stuff out. I really like the way Lucas played the Cat King.
Oh, Edwin, what was it you just said to me?
I don't see the harm in one little spell. Look, it comes right off as soon as you make me happy.
And lonely. And you know, it's like you get that through the bottom. It's like he wants somebody too, and he's not able to get it.
Yeah. And Lucas is having a ton of fun playing this character. Like, he's going all out.
But you can tell. Absolutely.
The fur coat, I was like, this is his I'm just Ken moment.
Yes. You know what? I want to talk about Kingham and Liddy for a second, the dandelion sprites. Uh-huh. Because as soon as they came on screen, I was like, oh my God, who are they?
I'm sobbing. It must be nice to have understanding friends.
It is. I don't have many friends.
Oh, I'm surprised. That makes sense.
Yeah, obviously. And now you're going to have even less because they're going to die in there.
They're all going to die.
I love them. I was thinking about it. It's like, it's as if Waldorf and Stettler from like the Muppets got to say what they really thought. And like, I love a good heckle. And throughout the whole show, they're just so rude.
Yeah, they could have so easily been throwaway characters too, or like silly, but I don't know if it was casting or writing or a combination of both, but they're just so funny that there's a moment where you think they're gone. And I was like, wait, bring them back immediately. Like, I really enjoy them.
Yes.
Both Lucas Gage and Jen Lyon on the show are kind of playing their parts kind of in the same way. They are both loaded down with dialogue, with exposition dumps, lore dumps.
Right.
I mean, at one point, the Lucas Gage character has to give you the origin story of the witch, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they both just sit there and they toss these lines aside like they're nothing. Yeah. So unforced. So natural. It's why they work.
I think the things I liked most about them, like their performance, is their timing.
Yeah, definitely.
Everything that they're saying, you're just like, oh my God. And it's, you know, not always trying to be funny, but I laughed every time they were on the screen because the way that they delivered their performance was just so spot on.
I like Yuu Kitamura, who played Nico throughout the series.
The neighbor.
Oh, mm-hmm.
She's a shut-in. She's afraid of the world, and she spent a long time in her bedroom. Her father has just passed. And when you meet her, she's this anime-obsessed, like, manga-reading, adorable outfits. Yeah, I was like, I so identify. A shut-in who just wants to read her manga?
Yes.
Queer. So gay. Even if the character is not a very gay motif.
Totally.
And she's just so delightfully weird and quirky in a not, you know, manic pixie dream girl way.
Is she, though?
Evil, go away! I'm almost there!
Oh, my gosh. I came to help. The internet said that banging pots and pans scares away the evil things.
But I thought their friendship was very natural and not forced and not at all relying on her to be quirky. But here we are, two weird people who have trouble connecting with folks, and we've connected with one another. And I really liked it. I didn't see her as a manic pixie dream girl, but did you?
I really liked that too. And I liked that she connected with Edwin right away, you know, because we've got him out here. He's obviously jealous of like Crystal. Then this other girl pops up and he's like, I think she's delightfully charming. And I was like, is he going to make a friend?
I think what I was dealing with is my own like oversensitivity, because we meet the character of Nico, the neighbor. She's played, as you mentioned, by Yuu Kitamura. When she's introduced in a pink cloud of manga characters floating around her head. And I was like, what are we doing? What is this? But the more time we spend with her, she gets to show us more and she becomes more. Mm-hmm. I do think she kind of stays at the level of manic pixie weird girl. You know, she's in love with love and she just wants everybody to be in love. And like, that's still a type.
Sure.
But worked for you.
Not only did it work for me, I think there's more to this character. We don't have time to explore it in season one because there are so many characters.
Right.
But you know, you bring up an interesting point. So your reaction to Nico's first appearance was my reaction to, are we having a coming out story in 2024? Like, I'm just so bored. Like, I don't care.
Oh, okay. So you were wary that we were getting yet another coming out story with Edwin's feelings for Charles.
Yes. But then as the story evolved, like, oh, this is not just a coming out story, although it's an element, I think, appropriate for the character and the age they come from.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's a much more prescient thing that will never go away, which is, oh my gosh, I'm gay and I might be in love with my best friend. It's me. Mm-hmm. I told my best friend in high school, I was like, I'm in love with you. What are we doing? How do we make it work? Similar reactions that happened afterwards. But it was so, like, I never really got this story as a kid. And I was like, man, as a high schooler, I would have really valued having this storyline of you can figure out how to manage your extreme love emotions in ways that are logical and make sense and don't destroy your friendship. And I thought that was really, I love that friendship is the core like relationship in this story. I think that seems to really apply to Gen Zers who are like, we really are looking for more friendship-centered stories. Mm-hmm. And for that to be the crux of this show, and for those friends to be so believable and so sweet, I want to in on their relationship. I'm like, can we also, I'll be your third. Like, what's happening? Mm-hmm. The showrunner was talking about how Gaiman sort of just leaves these very encouraging little notes and was not hyper involved, but mm-hmm. was sort of just checking in. Mm-hmm. But there's something about these worlds he creates that are so letters to weirdos and freaks. And like, they very much feel to me like desperate pleas to keep living. You don't have to give up. There's so much value in living, even mm-hmm. if you've done things that you feel bad about or you have remorse about. And so I thought, gosh, this is the kind of show I wish I had as a kid. Like, I feel it feels in ways like Buffy a lot was the show that helped me a lot as a kid. And I think it could do a lot of good for teenagers. I hope it does.
Yeah, I think the darkness, the elements of darkness, whether it's relationships or friendships, were something that I really, really enjoyed. It's like, I'm thinking about to when I was a teenager, the type of shows that were going on. Like, the drama was all about love, period. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to dive into the psyches of these people and to see what else is going on with their lives, to kind of be surprised by their motivations or the way that they respond to things because of what has happened in their past, and not like, oh my God, I have a crush and now I'm so tortured, you know, that was really fun for me.
Yeah, well, let's talk. Buffy's been mentioned several times, so let's dig into that. This is the Buffy formula, right? This the structure of the show. Monster of the Week with season-long arc plus teenage angst. That's the formula. And you know, I say teenage. Let's be real.
They're adults.
These are Hollywood teenagers, right? Okay. Everyone's in their 20s. Yeah. These two lead characters are both around 13. They are boys. The title makes sense. Here they are clearly adults. So I call it mm-hmm. dead twink detectives because that seems a lot more what the show's about. But in terms of the formula, okay, I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. It does mean it falls into my least favorite thing about shows like this, which is oh my God, these tiny, tiny babies are in danger from this monster. There's no time. There's no time. There's no time. Hey, can we talk about our relationship? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think the problem, I guess, like with that formula that I had in the very beginning, I'm like, oh man, are you going to throw all the paranormal tropes at me? Like the teenagers fighting the this. And I was like starting to lose interest, but I will say that like after the third episode, they got me. I was invested. Like the second episode with the Dandelion Sprites, as soon as they popped up, I was like, all right, I'm going to stay and watch this because what are they going to do? Are they going to keep them or not? But after that Devlin episode, I was like, all right, you guys are doing some really, really dark things and I'm here for it.
To your point, Glenn, there were moments where I was like, I don't care about this case as much, or we're kind of like trapped in here. And like, and then there's also a moment where they are in the most possible danger they could be in and they stop to have a relationship talk. And I'm like,
exactly.
There is no reason for you to be stopped right here. That does sort of take you out. And I think I hope it's something they tighten up a little bit in the future. But I would say it didn't kick me out of the show. It didn't destroy it for me, but it was definitely a moment where I was like, I don't know why this is happening.
But it felt kind of predictable in that way. Like, of course they're going to have this moment right now.
When they should be getting the hell out of there. Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, I guess I would prefer that to the other thing that these shows fall into, which this does as well, which is the other person, instead of like having the big relationship talk, they go, I don't want to talk about it. So then for five episodes, it's just this thing bubbling under the surface for no reason. One conversation would solve it.
Right. Or the constantly being interrupted when you're trying to have that moment. And the person, because we're so close, I assume that I know what you're talking about. Don't worry about it. You know, that was really frustrating for me, but it also felt a little bit real considering what Charles had just gone through.
Mm-hmm. But again, I go back and forth on that because that's kind of characteristic of the genre. Is it even possible to make that less clunky? Do you know of any other shows that have managed to make that work seamlessly? Mm. I mean, Buffy turned emotional trauma of high school into monsters that you can punch, right? And so it worked on a metaphorical level.
Right.
It worked on a grounded dynamic level because, sure, Angel is an evil vampire who delights in torturing people. He's also a bad boyfriend. So both of things can be true simultaneously. I think that merged it. But other shows like this are kind of having to kind of – they don't work on two levels at once. They kind of vacillate between the two levels they're working on.
Yeah, that's making me think of Charmed too.
Sure.
I think maybe X-Files might be the best example of not too frequently getting caught in this trap. Like – when they were in danger, they're like, we got to focus. We have a case to solve. I feel like they were waiting until they got back to the office or in the car to have their emotional conversations.
Yep. Right.
But yeah, but that's also a very adult show. And so I think there's space to be like, you know, this show felt to me accessible to like a 13 plus crowd. Mm-hmm. So I guess I don't mind some of the cornier parts. I also feel like young kids, great musical education. If you watch this series, download the tracks immediately. When Owner of a Lonely Heart started playing, I was like, we are in great hands. Let's do this. Prove yourself. You are the move you make.
in that scene where Jenny's singing Circles in the Sand, I was like, oh my goodness, I haven't heard that song in forever.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Well, you've heard what we have to say. We dig this. We want to know what you think about Dead Boy Detectives. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Nikki Birch, Joelle Monique, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Glenn.
See you next time.
See you next time. This episode was produced by Hafsa Fathima and Liz Metzger and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Your business faces specific challenges and unique opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, custom tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the expertise, strategy, and resources of a top 10 commercial bank, a dedicated team works with you to support your success and help achieve your goals. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you're carrying around a lot of stress, therapy is a safe space to get it off your chest. If you're considering therapy, give BetterHelp a try at BetterHelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.